Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Online, kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. This is the Thursday edition. Coming up on today's show, a quick check of some of the headlines, see what's going on out there, including the threat of earthquakes in Oklahoma. There's a new report about that. If driving and firing a tank sounds like it'd be a lot of fun to you, there's an actual vacation where you can do that. We've got some details about that. And also, machine learning is bringing the cosmos into focus. New ways to look at the universe. Pretty interesting. That and more on Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio on this Thursday. We're at 101.3 KPCG and trumpet.com, also kpcg.fm. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And any comments you'd like to send, email those to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau here today. How you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah, we haven't seen you in a while.
Yes.
You've been hiding.
Yeah, I've been... Sneaked away in another corner of the campus.
You've been, Canadians hibernate during this time of the year, and then you come out in the spring.
That's
Is that
true.
Right?
I think we hibernate in the summer and then come out for the Winter Olympics.
I got it mixed. Yeah, for hockey season. Yeah. I got that mixed up. Well, it's good to have you in today. Here are some of the stories that are happening. This is one that's just come across from CNN.com. U.S. launches airstrikes in Yemen. The United States conducted 20 airstrikes against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen overnight, according to two U.S. officials. U.S. manned and unmanned aircraft struck multiple locations, including targets in Aiban, Shabwa, and the Badia regions. The official added that the military assesses that al-Qaeda personnel were killed. These are the first strikes since the ones to target the Yemen-based terror group, that one that happened in January where some people got killed. I think the Navy SEAL got killed. These are the first since then. So these are the type of events that they don't tell you they're going to do them. They tell you they did them.
And right.
So this, the ongoing war against terror, I guess.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that al-Qaeda has clung on to existence.
Yeah.
For so long that even after the war on terror, and I think probably pressure on them has been relieved ever since we left Iraq, but still they've morphed into ISIS, Boko Haram, and other different groups around the world, and they're still causing trouble, and we're still having to spend millions of dollars fighting them. And so there's still a big threat, especially in Yemen. That's where that close to a sea gate, where they can cut off world trade. So it's just really interesting to see that as time goes on, they start to really attack strategic areas, and we still haven't figured out how to beat them yet.
It's hard to beat a ideology.
Yes.
They're very, very much focused in on their way of thinking, and it's hard to defeat that. So that was it. That's what happened, I guess, overnight. U.S. launched airstrike in Yemen. Here's another headline. This is from Fox News. Eric Holder, you remember him. Obama preparing to get back into the political spotlight. So, for better or for worse. And they said he's coming back. Former President Obama is getting ready to jump back into the political pool, former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said Tuesday. Holder said he has been talking with Obama about different ways to help the new National Democratic Redistricting Committee. According to Politico, Obama asked Holder to be a chairman of the group last year. He's ready to roll, Holder told reporters at a briefing. So he's set up there in Washington, D.C., not too far from the Capitol. He has an office. He can't do political things out of that office, but he has a house that he pays for, and he can do what he wants out of that house. So apparently he's going to be getting back into politics on some level.
Yeah, I'm not sure if people are surprised at this, since he has taken so many shots at Donald Trump's policies since leaving office. But this would be unprecedented, since almost every president except for one I can think of back in the 1800s who was both president and Supreme Court justice. But that was before they made more rules. That was way back in time. But especially in modern times, most presidents disappear into retirement, and they write books, or they have still have prestige, but they don't engage in active politics. So this would be a big break of precedent, and he's still really the Democrats' only hope, because with Nancy Pelosi and the other leaders there, they're really struggling to really get any traction.
Yeah, and they're getting older too, and he's still a pretty young guy. 50s maybe?
I think so.
Early 50s, yeah. That's what's always interesting when a president's pretty young when he's out of office, because he's got some time left. What do? Well, you do what you know how to do, I guess, which is usually write books, give speeches, and sometimes get back into things. But that's pretty rare. Like you said, usually they don't step back into the politics. Here's an interesting one from Zero Hedge. It's always kind of interesting when there's new weapons or advanced weapons that come out. This one's called the Silent Hunter. It's China's new armored vehicle slicing laser gun. Sounds like something out of a comic book.
Yeah.
It's a real deal, though.
That's interesting. Does it say if they've tested it successfully or not?
Well, they're touting it as if they can. They didn't give details in the story. It's Polytechnologies. It showed off the Silent Hunter, one of the world's most powerful laser weapons. We all have, you know, you can get those little laser pointers. This is next level from those. It claims an output of at least 50 to 70 kilowatts. Currently, the U.S. has one that's 33 kilowatts. So it's obviously more than doubled, depending on the range there. The Silent Hunter laser is powerful enough to cut through light vehicle armor up to a kilometer away. That's what they're claiming. Making you wonder, they say, if China already has more powerful laser weapons only for domestic use. But there's a debate, and this is out of my realm of knowledge, but if you could make a vehicle that just had reflective armor that would send it back. Like, if you read the comments to the story, there's a lot of quote-unquote experts, and maybe they know more than, maybe they do know a lot, but they're debating whether or not this would be valuable. So maybe it would be, but maybe it wouldn't be. I don't know enough to know, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think every nation has been pursuing laser technology and to weaponize it. I know the U.S., they've been building, well, it's still in testing phase, I think, but a laser that can shoot down nuclear weapons. Basically, it's on a plane. And because a nuclear weapon travels so fast, the only thing that can catch it is light. Because any other missile device would miss, or it doesn't have a high probability. So they're developing a laser that can shoot down these missiles, or at least neutralize them before they can arm and explode. So the U.S. has been working on that for over a decade. I remember Britain had, they made a electromagnetic shield for their tanks to deflect bullets. And then with these other laser weapons, like the one China has here, from what I understand, I don't know very much either, but the biggest problem is the power source, because to create intensity that high, you need really big batteries.
Yeah.
They better not be lithium batteries. And then also they're unreliable. The light can refract,
yeah,
like as it's traveling, and it can miss, or, and then it's, there are other ways to defeat those kind of weapons.
Yeah. They were commenting that, it makes the weapon that's a big target, because like you said, the heat and the everything it has to do to generate this, it's going to be easy to spot. I think they're thinking that it'll shoot down drones. I think that's what they're thinking about. Some of the commenters were sort of funny. They said that after they get done shooting through the fog there in, or the smog in China, there won't be much left of the laser. So anyway, they're unveiling new weapons all the time, and they probably have some good applications and some that maybe aren't as effective. But anytime you hear about lasers, I don't know, it just seems more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still something that's not practical yet. But what's interesting about China is they haven't fought a war against a major power since Korea. So all these weapons and things they haven't actually fought a war, except against the people in Tibet, I guess.
Right.
But otherwise, they haven't been in a major conflict to actually test these things on a battlefield, unlike the U.S., which has been fighting for a long time. So it makes, when they make these claims, it's interesting because they have so limited experience now that a lot of people just don't know if they're bluffing or
right,
or exactly what's going on.
Here's a, this could be potentially pretty good news, I guess. Maybe there's some danger in this, but this is from USA Today. Out west, the snow is so deep that scientists don't have tools to measure it. The snowpack is that deep. The Sierra Nevada is wrapping up a historic winter, and that's huge news for Nevada and California, states that have spent the past several years parched in drought. One gentleman, the scientist, says, who would have thought this 2 years ago when we were measuring the worst snowpack on record? They've gone from the worst 2 years back to now it's the biggest in history, recorded history anyway. The snowpack is, I don't know, now they tell us how deep it is, but they just told us they couldn't measure it. So maybe this is where they can measure it. The snowpack is 212 inches deep on the Slide Mountain site. Water content at the site was 74.6 inches. Meaning there's more than 6 feet of water in the 17-foot snowpack. It's a record for March 1st at the site. So when that melts, you're going to have some good water. It's going to help with the drought. I don't know if it would be too much water and if it would cause problems, but it's a record in any case.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Even when I was traveling to Canada, because we traveled westward, we're traveling Oklahoma, Kansas, halfway through Colorado. It's all brown. It's parched. As soon as you hit middle of Colorado, getting to Wyoming and the Dakotas, it's just covered in snow. There's just like a big divide there where there's just so much snow on the ground. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see if even if the California infrastructure, like all the dams and things with the rivers, can even withstand that much runoff because they've been having enough problems with that lately.
Yeah, somebody mentioned to me earlier this year that did travel down from Canada that they went through the Dakotas and they actually had to go 6 hours out of the way that they normally wanted to go or that they had planned to go because of how deep the snow was. And obviously up there, you're used to snow, so it's not like it's for lack of equipment or lack of ability to remove it, but if you just get too much, there's nothing you can do about it. So a lot of snow in some parts of the U.S. this year. And in other parts, not. We've been, we haven't had, not that we usually get a lot, but we haven't had much of anything, maybe one little thing. And we've been warm. You know, we've been in the 70s and even almost close to 80. So it's kind of, like you say, it's a strange divide, really warm and then huge snowpacks and kind of extremes on both sides.
Yeah, it's something odd. And just with the Gulf Stream going so far north, that's why we have all the warm air in the Midwest. And, I think a lot of people are getting scared for summer now because if this trend continues, it's going to get real hot.
What's going to happen? This is a write-up from the LA Times. It affects us here in Oklahoma and those in Kansas. Oklahoma's earthquake threat now equals California's because of man-made temblors, according to the USGS. A lot of debate about that. Why so many more earthquakes in Oklahoma? A lot of people think it's because of the drilling for oil and the way they're going about that with the wells and things. So they say the earthquakes are thought to be the result of the disposal of wastewater deep underground that are a byproduct of oil extraction. Injecting the wastewater underground is not thought to trigger the earthquakes everywhere it is practiced, in North Dakota, for example, but is widely believed by scientists to be a problem in Oklahoma. A lot of debate on that. I suppose you could find people on both sides that would be pretty convincing. But no matter the cause, we've had quite a few more earthquakes, and now we are the we have the biggest threat of earthquakes. Us in California, now we're tied. Who would have thought? Oklahoma and California.
Yeah. I think just maybe 7 years ago, people didn't even know Oklahoma had a fault line in it. But now it makes headlines because there just have been so many earthquakes over the past few years. And I'm not sure. In Oklahoma, I guess the biggest threat would be all the pipelines going into Cushing there, because that's the main hub in the Midwest. So if there are big earthquakes, there isn't a huge threat to infrastructure like California, like in a city. But maybe if it breaks apart those pipelines, that could cause trouble.
Yeah. According to scientists, there were only about 2 earthquakes a year of magnitude 2.7 or greater in Oklahoma from 1980 to 2000, that 20-year gap there, or window. But that number jumped to 2,500 in 2014. And then 2015, we had 4,000. A little bit of a jump.
Yeah.
If I could get paid for every earthquake, I'd be a rich man. And we've all felt them. The only earthquakes I have ever felt have been here in Oklahoma. And never until a few years back. And then, I haven't felt any in a while. So I don't know if it's slowing down some or what's happened, but anyway, they say there's still a pretty good threat there.
Yeah, I think once in a while, I'm not sure if it is, but you hear like the rumbling and the house or building creak a lot, like a pretty big bang sometimes. So I think they're just very small tremors that most people probably don't even feel. But I remember that when that big one came through, I was still in college and I was at the dorm, and the whole dorm was shaking, and I woke up and I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And I went into the hallway and all the guys got out and they were talking about it. And then I just went back to bed because I didn't need to hear everyone's recounting of the drama of the 10 seconds it was going on or whatever it was.
Yeah, they usually don't last too long here, but we have had a couple, like you mentioned, that it went for a while. And then your nervousness starts to ramp up a little bit. What's going to happen? So we used to just have tornadoes. That was the thing. Now we've got earthquakes and tornadoes. What's next? Fire? Well, we have fire. We have wildfires, too. I can't think of what else would come. Yeah. That's kind of it. So we don't want to scare you off from Oklahoma. It's not a bad place, but we do have to worry about these earthquakes now, just like California.
We did have the cricket apocalypse
a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where there's just so many crickets that literally the row would move. There's so many you drove over them, it sounded like popcorn.
That's right. I had not thought about that in a while, but yeah. I do remember early in the morning opening the door to walk outside, and it sounds like you're walking on a... fortune cookies.
Yeah.
Sorry for the visual there, but yeah, they were everywhere. Nothing you could do about it. So I don't know why that was exactly. It was something to do with the, it always has to do with the weather, I think, usually. You know, if it doesn't get cold enough here, you get a lot more insects in the spring and summer because it doesn't kill them off. You get more spiders and other things. So maybe we'll have that this year because we had one cold snap, didn't we?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was cold enough, but it's been warm.
Yeah, with those apocalypses or when there's that huge explosion of insects, sometimes it's the cycle of their mating where they all, every like 10, 12 years, there's a cycle where there's just a huge population explosion because I don't know all the reasons, but that I heard some people explain it that way where we just happened to land on one of those cycles at the time.
Yeah, I remember that a couple of years back. So always interesting, always exciting, never a dull moment. Subway restaurant's a pretty popular restaurant, but it could be that their food's not exactly what you think. There's a report out, came from Canada actually, that they tested the chicken in restaurants, and they came back saying that Subway chicken was only about 50% chicken. That was the lowest of all the restaurants, like McDonald's and everything. Now Subway has fired back at, quote, absolutely false allegations that their chicken is fake. Fake news, fake chickens, fake reports. You just want some truth these days.
Yeah. I went to Subway yesterday, but thankfully I only get the steak and cheese.
There you go.
That's the only thing I'll ever get there.
I'm a steak and cheese guy. I like those.
Yeah.
They haven't tested the steak yet that I know of. After a Canadian study revealed that Subway's chicken may only contain about half actual chicken, the sandwich chain is vehemently denying the validity of the allegations. They said the accusations made by CBC Marketplace about the content of our chicken are absolutely false and misleading. Our chicken is 100% white meat with seasonings marinated and delivered to our stores as a finished cooked product. That was what a spokesperson told NBC News in a statement. They said, we have advised them of our strong objections. We do not know how they produce such unreliable and factually incorrect data, but we are insisting on a full retraction. Producing high-quality food for our customers is our highest priority. This report is wrong, and it must be corrected. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But whenever you get that bug in your ear of, hey, that may not be what you think it is, a lot of people don't want to eat it anymore.
Yeah, whether it's right or wrong, some people just go with it anyway. And it is interesting with these things sometimes. It's not the company's fault. It's the food provider lies or has a bad batch or those kinds of things happen. Or even, I don't even know how they tested that. How many chains they tested and that sort of thing. But
they went through, they tested several chains, McDonald's, Wendy's, Tim Hortons, A&W and Subway, all the other restaurants came in between 85 to 90% chicken. They tested the DNA. Subway came in at 53.6. The rest of it, they say, was soy.
Huh.
Not totally soy, but because they said there is seasonings and other things that make up some of it, but they thought the substantial part of it that wasn't chicken was made up of soy.
That's interesting, because that's maybe that's just what they're feeding the chickens.
That could be.
And that's just it, because that some of that food just artificially grows them, and maybe you're just eating the soy that the chickens are eating.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, you should be working there. You should be working on these reports.
Yeah, well, my problem, though, is I just stay at Tim Hortons all the time and just keep testing the Timbits and the donuts.
I'm still testing here, and it all is checking out, but I need to do a few more reports. Yeah, DNA testing. So that would probably make restaurants pretty nervous if they come around and they say, hey, we just want to test your food real quick. And, you know, that would be a bad deal. I guess it just depends on what supplier you're buying from. It's not like Subway has a chicken farm.
Yeah.
As far as I know, maybe they do, but I imagine they just buy from a big company. But yeah, you don't know what you're eating sometimes, whether it's bread product or whether it's meat. There's a lot of different things in there, and I don't think we know what it does to the body all the time. Usually it's not good.
Yeah. I mean, these reports, they might be inaccurate sometimes or whatnot, but they are still great because it does keep food companies honest, and there are plenty of stories and examples out there of when they did catch companies artificially putting things into their food that would be cheaper. Like there's always reports about certain cereals having sawdust in them.
Oh, really?
I think up to 5% sawdust and like not necessarily Cheerios, but like General Mills cereals and that sort of thing.
Why would that be?
Because apparently it just helps. It's cheaper because you don't have to put flour and everything else, and it makes it look a certain way.
Huh.
I forget exactly what their reasonings were, but I'm not sure if they still do it, but I think it was about 5 years ago maybe some of those reports came out.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't want to know.
Yeah.
You don't want to know what's in there at times. Well, here's an interesting story. You know, sometimes you probably think to yourself, should I just get out of bed when the alarm goes off, or should I hit snooze a couple of times?
Right.
I think most people get into a routine. I kind of have a little bit of a snooze routine where I know how many times I can hit snooze before I... And I've heard a lot of theories about that. Some people say it's better to sleep straight through. Others say it's better to do the snooze. I like to do the snooze. I feel like I'm getting a little extra sleeping. What about you? You like the snooze or no?
It depends. Usually when my alarm gets off, I'm awake and I can't go back to sleep even if I'm tired. So sometimes I miserably just lay in bed for a while until I muster the will to get up. But most of the time I think I'm awake no matter if I want to be or not.
Here's a story where a man hits the snooze button and he avoids being impaled. Yes, this happened in Indiana. In Indiana, man's decision to press the snooze button may have very well saved his life. Raymond Bowling of Austin, Indiana, told Fox 59 that he sets his alarm each day for 5:30 a.m. He says he usually presses the snooze button once, and then 9 minutes later, he gets out of bed to start getting ready for work. He said, "This morning I hit snooze, and I lay there for a few minutes, got up on my feet, and looked at how many minutes were left on snooze. About 6 minutes were left. So I decided to lay back down until it went off again," which is, I don't know, if I'm up, I'm up.
Yeah.
Like, if I can get over the hump of getting out of bed, I'm up. I'm not going to go back, probably. He went back. 6 minutes, he said, "I'm going to lay back down." The decision prevented him from getting impaled by a tree branch that crashed through the roof as severe storms moved across the state. He said he fell back asleep, and if he had not have done that, he would have probably been brushing his teeth. That's his routine, and the branch landed right where he would have been brushing his teeth, and it would have probably seriously injured or killed him, so... Fluky.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get the snooze button going on by. I use my iPhone as a alarm clock. But yeah, that's pretty dramatic.
But, you know, I'm sure there's other stories where if they had kept sleeping like normal, they would have been impaled. You know, it goes every which way. But, the other night we had a pretty strong gust of wind come through and knocked some branches off of a tree in my yard. And, we don't have too many trees close to the house, but you do have to think about that. If you've got a tree real close to your house or kind of goes over your house, things like that can happen. Tree branch gets snapped off and goes through or something.
Yeah, I think the closest I know, it wasn't me personally, but my brother, when we lived in Calgary, Alberta, we would take the bus a lot, go everywhere, and he was taking the bus home from work. And he was just standing there. The bus pulled up. He let some other people get on in front of him. And at those bus stops, there's like those glass huts, mm-hmm. little glass huts for people to wait in. He stepped out of there. He literally put his right foot on. Then as soon as he got his left foot on the bus, like through the door, a truck came through, like scraping the side of the bus, took out the whole glass hut, and just wiped out everything that was right there beside the bus.
Wow.
So if he was on a split second later, he would have been hit by the truck as it went through. So it was just that close to getting hit.
Yeah. You have something like that happen, you just kind of sit there and think, wow. The only thing I had happen was I lost control of my car on the interstate one time, icy roads, and did a 360 across the interstate and came to rest without damaging my car, hitting anybody. I just kind of came up against the snowbank and I just sat there thinking, ooh.
Yeah.
And then you just keep going. But it's you have that moment of like, wow, I could have been dead there. But yeah. It didn't happen. So those are, probably everybody's got a story like that. Or if they don't, they're probably closer to it than they realized.
Yeah, there's actually when I went back to Canada during college in the winter, my brother and I, we were driving around and he just bought the car for just a few months. So he was proud of it. He was showing it off to me. It was a Chevy Impala.
Uh-huh.
And we were driving through and we were turning left through a pretty big intersection. And it's that hard packed down snow because people have been driving on it for a while. So as he's turning left, we fishtail.
Yeah.
And so we slide. I'm looking down, texting a friend. And as I'm just looking down, I'm not looking outside, and I feel the car moving oddly. So I'm like, huh, that's kind of weird. And we slide through the lane we're trying to go through sideways. There's two cars in the other lane waiting there at the red light. We keep sliding sideways and go right behind them into the snowbank. And as we're sliding, I just look up. I'm like, huh. And I just keep texting.
You're cool as a cucumber in a very very dire circumstance. Sometimes people this time of year, especially heading into spring, summer, they start thinking about taking a vacation maybe. And vacations sometimes are a little more normal. Go to the beach or maybe you go have an adventure of some kind. If you like adventures, here's one for you. This is from CNN.com. You can go down to Texas and you can drive a tank and fire a real gun for fun. Would this interest you?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be interested in this. The guy says, the author says that he was driving a Sherman tank mounted with a 76-millimeter gun. And so you get in, and I mean, they give you a little bit, I guess, of understanding of how to drive the thing. And then you go through a course, and they kind of set it up like it's a battle. Because there's explosions that go off. The author says, we were under attack, sort of. A high explosive charge went off as we plunged into a small creek, followed by another blast. And soon I heard machine gun fire from a pillbox on a hill, all part of the simulated battlefield experience. Feeling the heat, the aching legs, and a bit of fear, guests may get a minimal understanding of what servicemen went through sitting in tanks under real-life fire out in the open, facing more powerful Panzer unit tanks in World War II. Gives you some idea of what they went through. So it'd be pretty interesting to try it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, any historian will tell you that the only way you can understand the subject is by actually being there, visiting the battlefield, visiting the building, whatever you're reading about or researching. You really can't understand it until you're physically there and you see what's left of that physical location. So with understanding what the men went through in battle, you really can't know that until you have an experience like that. And I think a lot of people would be interested in that. And just, it's also a very beneficial educational experience because a lot of men died in those Sherman tanks because they had such thin armor. They were much faster than Panzer units or Tigers, the German tanks, but they had pretty thin hulls. And so a lot of them would die just from getting... when the shell hit the tank, it would just get ripped apart. And so when you're in that little sardine can driving through a battle, I think it makes people think about the mental dexterity that a lot of those tanker crews had.
Yeah, you can go check this out. It's at a place called Ox Ranch, and you can pay anywhere from a few hundred dollars to shoot some machine guns to over 8,000 for the full deal. That's a lot of money to spend. Tank driving, shooting, and you can also do a flamethrower. So it's always interesting to me how people come up with different business ideas. You know, however they got all this military stuff, and they thought, huh, I wonder if people would pay to go around and, you know, simulate a battle. So I could see a lot of people really being interested in that. And that's a place down in Texas. You can check that out if you're interested and you've got some money to spend. You want to take the family down there for a tank driving activity.
Yeah, I just had a friend who got married, so, and I think they went to Disney World for the honeymoons. Like they missed out. They should have gone to Texas.
They blew it. Yeah, they blew it. They could. Nothing says honeymoon like a tank.
Yeah.
And a flamethrower. Yeah, I imagine the people that, of course, they'd be quite old now, but. Those that actually fought in those vehicles would probably want nothing to do with the place. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times you hear that from people that served in the military. They're not as keen on it as the others would be. But because of the traumatic experiences of doing it for real, as opposed to sort of just a fun to drive the thing around.
Yeah. Well, for all those people who are veterans, I imagine whenever you're in that scenario, you remember all the people that were lost rather than the exhilaration or victory or anything like that. I mean, there's good times too, but I imagine, as with anything, it's the negative memories that come back first, yeah. Especially in those kind of environments.
Yeah, for sure. So kind of interesting vacation idea. Of course, this one happened. This will make everyone feel maybe a little bad, but also maybe good if you're older. 90-year-old man in sandals does 24 pull-ups on his birthday. 90-year-old gentleman. He doesn't bother putting on the gym wear, khakis and sandals. He did 24 pull-ups. 90-year-old Vern from Florida recently put everybody to shame, the author says, when his son recorded him doing pull-ups on his birthday. According to his son, the two regularly go to the gym together to work out despite Vern's old elbow injuries. The son said, we go to the gym regularly and he loves to do pull-ups. I think he does pretty good considering he broke both elbows as a kid. And so he's wearing these cargo pants and sandals and did 24 pull-ups consecutively at 90 years of age. That's pretty amazing. Most people can't do that.
Yeah, I would say that's decent at least.
Oh, man, for sure.
Because most 90-year-olds are, or people a lot younger, are pretty incapacitated or just slowing down. And so that's good for him that he's still able to do that and has some dexterity left.
It made me think, how many pull-ups should you be able to do? This is according to physicalliving.com. They say children between the ages of 6 and 12 years of age should be able to perform between 1 to 2 pull-ups, and that seems pretty doable. Teens, they say boys 13 to 18 years of age should be able to perform between 3 to 8 pull-ups, and the older you are, the more reps you have to do to keep up with the average. And girls 13 to 18 years of age should be able to perform 1 pull-up or a 5-9 second flexed arm hang. 5-9 second arm. We did that when we were younger in grade school. We did the flexed arm hang. And then we got older, we had to do pull-ups. I was good right at the flexed arm hang, not as good as the pull-ups.
Yeah, well, with pull-ups, I think I used to be able to do more than 20 at once. I can't do that right now. But back when I would work out more. And when I was in Jerusalem, went to a bunch of gyms just to see what was around there. Wherever I go, I try to go to the gym just to kind of get a feel of what's going on. And
try to intimidate the other residents.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Look who's in town. So,
look out, folks. Look who just got here.
But some of those, what I've noticed is just the big thing is strength to weight ratio. Some guys are huge, but they're so heavy they can't do as many.
Right.
And then some teenagers who weigh 100 pounds can do 30 or 40 just because they don't weigh anything and they're really strong. So some of it's that ratio. And but basically, if you work at it, you can do them. It just takes a lot of time.
For adults, data for adults is harder to come by, they say, for pull-ups. But according to the research from this website, this is what they think. Men should be able to perform at least 8 pull-ups, and 13 to 17 reps is considered fit and strong. A woman should be able to perform between 1 to 3 pull-ups and 5 to 9 reps is considered fit and strong. So now we all know if we're fit and strong or not. But yeah, anytime you see somebody that's older, especially 90 years old, doing something like that, a lot of things have to be going the right way for you. You've had to avoid serious injury, although this guy was hurt, but not something he couldn't recover from. Avoid illness, you know. He looked to be a smaller guy in terms of height and that type of thing. So anyway, that's pretty interesting and maybe encouraging and maybe discouraging. I don't know. I think the encouraging thing is, hey, everybody could probably get closer to that, even if you're not doing it right now.
Yeah. Well, I think lots of studies show that if you weightlift a little bit, not seriously, but just exercise with weights a little bit, it does prevent aging. Mm-hmm. And especially in the major, maybe not on the skin and not what you look like, but on the inside systems in your body, it helps prevent aging. So yeah, that's certainly a testament to that.
Yeah. Keep moving. If you keep moving, you typically do okay. If you stop, you stop.
Yeah.
you're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online, and we're at kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening to us today, and you can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. If you'd like to send any emails, please do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. If you want to send us videos of yourself doing pull-ups, that'd be great. and then we'll get some of Abraham. We'll see how many he can do. I'm going to bow out immediately as I cannot even begin to compete. The Key of David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Make sure you listen for that. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Brent Nachtigall today, filling in for regular host Stephen Fleury. And he's coming to us from Jerusalem. Talked about Iran is pushing the world toward World War III. He says Bible prophecy indicates that World War III begins with a pushy foreign policy by a Middle Eastern nation. And in today's program, Brent looks at two recent actions by Iran that are creating the environment in which this push will take place. Check that out coming up today. Also, archives at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Related to that, here's a report from Fox News. It says Iran reportedly poised for weapons shopping spree after UN ban is lifted. They're about to go buy some weapons. No surprise. This is going to be a major military shopping spree, they say, in 2020 after a UN ban prohibiting the country from purchasing sophisticated weapons is lifted. Bloomberg, citing a report from the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence, reported that Iran will be shopping for surface warships, submarines, and anti-ship missiles. They're thinking about their Navy.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think just over the past couple of years, most of the threats to Iran on land have been neutralized. ISIS is pushed all the way back in Syria, even though they're not much of a threat. Iraq is pretty much under Iran's heel. Afghanistan and Pakistan aren't causing any troubles. And so there isn't a need for them to have a huge army like in the 1980s when they were fighting against Iraq in that huge war for 10 years. And so and now any power who wants to be recognized internationally needs a navy, because trade, the global economy, is based on water transport. So if a nation wants prestige, if they want power, they need to have a navy and control some kind of trade route or a trade point. And that's what Iran's doing, especially since with their geography, they're right next to one in the Strait of Hormuz. So this isn't a big surprise, but what's really dangerous is that if they do get these sophisticated weapons, it will make it much more difficult to break a blockade on Hormuz if they choose to do so.
Yeah, and they're using their best asset, which is that waterway. That's the thing that they have going for them if they can control it. You've got some information for us on some of the history of Iran's Navy and what they've been up to over the years. And so what do you have for us?
This is really interesting, because I think after researching through this, the biggest overall point of it is that now finally in 2017, Iran is picking up where the Shah left off in 1970. So in the 1960s, especially 1970, Britain withdrew from the Gulf. They had a pretty big naval presence in the Persian Gulf. Britain had, since the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nation mandates, they had a pretty big interest in the Arab nations like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia. And so when they withdrew in the 1970s, when they were cutting back on their defense expenditures with a labor government in there, that's when the Shah, who was friendly with the West, he started to really build up the Navy in a big way. He started building a few ships, but he bought a bunch of ships from the United States, Great Britain, some other European countries. And so the Shah, what he wanted to do was build a blue water fleet capable of showing off his strength to his neighbors and really build up his regional power. But the thing is, the Shah was friendly to the West. And that's the big point to remember, because he was willing to even participate in certain NATO exercises. He would NATO regulations. He would act as if he was an extension of NATO, helping the U.S. and Europe combat Soviet influence, especially in Egypt, because Egypt was the big power player there for Russia against Israel and the United States. And so the Shah had a big drive to build a navy right before he was deposed in 1979. His big goal was to expand his influence into the Indian Ocean. That was the next frontier for Iran. But when he was deposed and Khomeini came in and Iran became an Islamic Republic, all that changed. All their agreements were cut off with other nations. And so their navy fell behind technologically. Khomeini executed all the top admirals in the navy. So the leadership took a long time to get to a level where they could compete with other trained armies and navies. And so now, finally, 2017, we're at a point where they're looking at the same goals the Shah did after really killing off all their leaders and then suffering sanctions and different restrictions. With those lifting with the Iran deal, they're finally starting to step into the ambitions and the goals of being a pretty big Navy force in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's interesting how long, I guess, it's taken for that radical government there in Iran to just secure their power. I suppose that's what they've been doing as far as, like you said, getting rid of the top leaders from the Shah's regime. But they've been really behind, like you said, in a lot of ways. I mean, if somebody says Iran's Navy, I would think most people don't think much about that. You know, we see the dinghies and the other things that they do, but they definitely have a will, and they definitely are anti-West now, which is different than the Shah. And they have an infusion of cash thanks to the last administration in the U.S. And now the sanctions are being lifted, so they're radicalized, and now they're getting this influx of money and power as well. So they're becoming dangerous in a way that they haven't been in a while.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And I think the big thing too is that Russia, they were very allied with Egypt until Sadat made the peace deal with Israel. And then Egypt ceased to be really a puppet of Soviet Russia. And now with Vladimir Putin bringing Russia back into power, he's allied with Iran. So now Iran gets Russian money, Russian support, Russian military equipment that circumvents any Western sanctions or limitations on them. And so that's a big reason why they've been able to survive. And also the war with Iraq really drained their resources, and they weren't able to expand outward as long as Saddam Hussein was in power. Khomeini couldn't really do much. But now that Saddam's out of the way for a long time, we really see Iran explode onto the scene as a power in the Middle East.
It's amazing how, really, if you look at all the different events, the Shah, the lifting of sanctions, the knocking off of Saddam Hussein, the U.S. has really built Iran. We built them into what they are, not that we've specifically, say, wanted it to become like what it is, but all those major events, you really point back to the U.S. on those, all the way back to the Shah being deposed. And so it's pretty amazing to see that. And they hate us, but yet the West, and the U.S. in particular, has done the things necessary for them to rise. Not that they've planned to do it that way, but that's the way it's worked out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that really reveals, I think, how short-sighted a lot of American strategists were, starting all the way with Jimmy Carter not giving the Shah sanctuary and really not helping him even prevent the revolution, pretty much abandoning him and allowing Iran to become radicalized. Reagan didn't have to worry about it because they were fighting Iraq. And then when President Bush took Desert Storm, and then when the later President Bush took out Saddam, I don't think they really realized what they were. They're opening a Pandora's box of radical Islam, and especially with the Shiites in Iran really uniting them across the Middle East and Northern Africa. I think they didn't have a plan for that. And they knew Iran was the biggest state sponsor of terrorism, but I think the biggest turning point was over the past 8 years was President Obama, where it wasn't short-sightedness or strategic mistakes. It was literally helping Iran.
Right.
Something done in error. It was active help of helping propping Iran as a power, moving away from Saudi Arabia and other friendly states, and basically crowning Iran as the king in that area. And it was actively done by the last president.
Yeah, really amazing. And that history all ties back into what you see happening in Iran today, and that's talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Brent Noctegal filling in today on Iran is pushing the world toward World War III. Make sure you check that out. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. There's some other headlines there. Beijing at sea is China crafting an Atlantic maritime strategy, a significant Iranian military exercise that ties in as well. That's at the Trumpet. And there's also an analysis piece that we talked about a week or so ago that you wrote, Abraham, that's on there, The Crisis of Angry Ignorance. And so check that out today. You're all over the place.
You're I try to be.
On the Trumpet, you're on the radio. So it's you can't get rid of Abraham if you want to. He's in everything today. You've got another write-up for us. It's pretty interesting. A lot of people, of course, really very inspired and very interested in what's going on out in the universe and space and the galaxies and such. The more they look, the more they find. This is from The Atlantic. Machine learning is bringing the cosmos into focus. They say training neural networks to identify galaxies could forever change humanity's perspective of the universe. It's pretty technical. What are they doing with their imagery for they're getting from space?
Yeah, so it's a pretty complicated subject, and I don't understand probably enough about it. But basically, what to simplify it, what they're doing now is because telescopes are the big way we observe the universe, whether that's Hubble telescope in the Canary Islands, owned by Spain. They have the world's largest telescope. Its lens diameter is 34 feet. Mm. So that's huge. A telescope, it captures the light, and on the lens, you get to see what it captures. But the problem is, no matter how big the lens is or how much light they capture, sometimes the human eye just can't detect everything. We can't, or make out precise images, because the human eye can only see a certain spectrum of light. So what they're doing now is all the information taken in from telescopes, they're putting through these big, basically supercomputers, and they're able to sharpen the image and actually give a fuller rendering of what the telescopes are capturing, because a computer can take into account everything on the electromagnetic spectrum, radio waves, X-rays, infrared, and then light as well, where humans can only see light. We can't see anything else. And so basically these computers, they work very quickly and they're able to sharpen blurry images. And that lets us see things we couldn't see before. Where on the Hubble, for example, when you zoom in, it's just a bunch of blurry dots that look like stars or like kind of just faint light in the distance. And these computers can sharpen the image where it's actually a galaxy.
Yeah.
And so it's helping us observe even more of the universe and giving us sharper rendering and it take into account even more that we can't even see. And that's really a neat part of it that I was fascinated by reading through this, is that we only see the light out there, and that's spectacular itself. But when you see all the other radiation out there, all the other spectrums that are produced by these huge celestial bodies, you really realize there's so much going on that we still don't understand, how all these powers are interacting and moving and everything. And these computers and this system, it's called a generative adversarial network. It's helping us learn even more about the universe.
Yeah, there's always, you know, they know there's dark matter out there, don't know exactly what it is, but it's some sort of a force that moves things, pushes, because the universe, as I understand it, it's, they explain it like it's being pulled from the outside by something,
right?
To where the further things get away from each other, the faster they move, which it goes against the Big Bang theory of blows out from the center and then it would slow down naturally. It's not. It's getting faster, unless that's changed since I was in college. But I think that, but that, I thought that was a good explanation. It's like two hands pulling it from the outside. And or how many of her hands? And right. So there's all, like you said, there's all kinds of things that they know, they can see, like the result, the results. They know something causes, but what caused it? How does it work? Those are things that they're just we're just seeing the little bit of. But the more you see, the more amazing it is. And I know that science, they base a lot of it on evolution. But I know when I took some classes in college, the more you look into some of the laws, the more you see a God there, a creator. Because it's too specific, it's too exact, and as much as they try to talk against that way of thinking, they can't help but kind of reveal God in a lot of ways because of just how exact some of these laws are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you just look at the probability of life on Earth happening randomly, beginning by having protein chains link up to create human life. Basically, it's 1 to, I think, like 50 zeros, 1 to, like 1 to the power of 50 zeros. It's just so minute possibility of that, and that's just one thing. Never mind the precise structure of the universe, all of the laws Newton discovered. Why are those even in place? Why does energy and force work in such a way where they don't destroy one another, they don't impact one another, but they work harmoniously? What decided all that? Was it chance? Probably not. And even Gene Cernan, the last man who walked on the moon, he said that going into space and looking at the Earth from the moon, it's a spiritual experience because you realize just how precise everything is, how perfect it is. And that the more you go into the universe, it's beautiful and we find more things, but we don't find life. We don't find anything close to the beauty of the Earth or anything close to the what's going on this one planet. And so it really does make us think, and it should make us question who designed it all and who's really making sure it's all running precisely on time.
Yeah, I saw this show, a science show, just a couple weeks ago. It's fascinating, and they're talking about some of the ways that they're trying to understand the universe more, and even as far as the way they want to send things up into like the space station, better ways to do it. And it's all about origami, which, you know, make the little crane or the little bird or whatever, but the folds, the folding patterns, and they're figuring out ways that they can send very compact things up into space and then open them up and they become quite large. And it went into a lot of things just about the way, even the way some of the universe is structured, they kind of think it relates sort of to origami, the way that things unfold. I didn't see enough of it to really understand it all, but the few minutes I saw of it, I thought it was fascinating because I always thought, you know, you think of origami as sort of like a kid's thing, like, well, yeah. But they're studying it at MIT. They developed a program where you can put in anything and it'll make an origami structure of it. I don't know if they've finished it yet or not, but it'll print out the paper or even 3D print maybe with all the folds. So you could fold it and you could make whatever in an origami type of compact shape and then open it up. It's just fascinating, you know, and I like it when things that are kind of simple. I mean, origami is not super simple, but I understand the concept. And then you can take it out and you see something like that in the universe. That's exciting to me because it's like, hey, I can kind of get that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what that shows is that there's a definite pattern of when something works on Earth in a very small scale, you can see it replicate on a much bigger scale. And they don't interact at any point. Since when does a piece of paper folding interact with the universe?
Right.
It doesn't. But there's similarities there. And at points that there was one overall mind designing everything, and there's, you can see similarities in certain things and the same patterns repeating. And I think that's one of the most exciting things, is that it's usually the best solutions are the simplest, and they're usually right under our nose, where something as simple as building a crane or just folding paper to make something that looks pretty can actually help us move to new levels in spaceflight. I mean, that's just such simple things usually are the best answers.
Yeah, it's really pretty amazing. And so they're getting better images from this these supercomputers that they're developing, or they're using to see these images from space. And I think they had a couple of examples in there, at least pictures from this Atlantic piece. And so it's pretty interesting. And that's, I guess, their hope is just that they'll see more.
Yeah, because there's only so much you can do with telescopes. Because structure, the metal only has, can make it so big, or you only can send one into orbit so big, like Hubble, or I forget what the replacement is called. But there are limitations on those things, how much light you can capture. But with these computers, it's allowing us to expand our capability much better than we could by just building something that's bigger.
That's one of the great questions that comes up in almost any field. You can get the data, but then do you know what the data means? The telescopes can capture the data, but can we interpret it?
Exactly.
And that's always the great question for a lot of things in life. And so pretty interesting. You can read the rest of that at The Atlantic. Machine learning is bringing cosmos into focus so we can see it better. And the more they look, the more things they see. It's pretty fascinating. That's all the time we've got for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.